Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You wake up in a slightly strange place. It's not Indonesia or Antarctica or anything, but still, what's that old expression, Dorothy?
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
No, not Kansas, Florida. From its singular ecology to its wacko politics, Florida prides itself on defying easy explanation and needing some serious translation.
Come on now, Toto, get off my leg. You've got to remember we're not in Kansas anymore.
Finding Florida in translation, it takes a Carl Hiaasen to make sense of the 27th state. Novelist, journalist Carl Hiaasen explains it all for you. On the Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. On this Thursday, March 11th, I'm once again down in South Florida at the studios of WLRN in Miami, waiting to be joined by Carl Hiaasen in just a moment. How's the weather in New York, Celeste?
Well, normally I'd be jealous of you down there in Miami during the winter months, but it is absolutely gorgeous in New York, I gotta say. Let's check in on the top stories this morning besides the weather. A big change on the horizon for the nation's education system, specifically how and what America's children will be taught. Yesterday, 48 governors and school chiefs proposed national standards. They call on states to teach specific topics in each grade level, replacing present guidelines that vary wildly from state to state. One example is, by third grade, all kids will need to know the difference between poetry and prose. The White House promises federal money to states that adopt this plan. But a big obstacle right now, as always, is funding. Last night, this Kansas City school board voted to close half of the city's public schools because of a $300 million deficit. There were reports that half the schools would be closed. Mayor Mark Funkhauser tells CNN this morning.
We got 233 schools in Kansas City. This plan closes 26 of those.
All the schools are in one district that will affect about 16,000 students.
Under the plan, there will be educational challenges in all states and localities. Florida may have some particular challenges of its own. Joining us now, Carl Hiaasen, novelist, journalist, columnist at the Miami Herald. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning.
You know the difference between poetry and prose, right?
Yeah, I don't write poetry.
Right, exactly. Poetry is what you don't write. But the serious question here, when did you understand that Florida politically and culturally needed a little translation for the rest of America?
Well, my whole life I realized it, but I think the seminal moment was the 2000 presidential election, Bush versus Gore. I think that's when the whole country got to see what a wonderful freak show we have going on down here.
Well, we're going to talk more about that, and particularly the contemporary freak show that's developing in Florida politics with Carl Hiaasen, who's going to join us in just a moment. There's something you can weigh in on while I'm in South Florida with our friends at WLRN Miami. We're asking the question, what does Haiti need from the world right now? If you've been affected by the earthquake, and especially if you're Haitian, what are you not getting that you still need? We've gotten some great responses so far. Join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org.
New economic numbers out last hour show the number of newly laid off workers getting unemployment benefits slipped last week. That's the second straight drop. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are up. European indices are down. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,567. The S&P opens at 1,145 and the NASDAQ at 2,358. We're also following the story this morning about how whites are becoming more and more the numerical minority in this country. You can get more information at our site, thetakeaway.org. And we're asking you to weigh in. How do these labels of majority and minority fit in your life?
For me, the change in population really makes no difference. I've always thought of minority and majority as terms of power, and given that I don't think any of the power dynamics are going to change once the population does, I'm just going to be happy to watch the white supremacists squeam.
Maybe she means squirm, watching them squirm. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to be talking more about this in just a half hour. Coming up, a conversation with Carl Hiaasen about the dysfunctional state of politics in the Sunshine State.
Good morning, everyone. Americans talk a lot about their frustrations with politics in Washington, but they may have more frustrations depending on what state they're from. And internationally, we talk a lot about failed states or or rogue states, that sort of thing. We're going to take a look at the state of Florida through that lens a little bit. And let's remind you all of what we are asking this morning. The people of Haiti still have needs since the earthquake in January. It's still a devastated place in need of different kinds of aid. We talked about it yesterday, but we've been asking you, what does Haiti need right now? And people in South Florida, where I am this week, have definitely been weighing in. We're going to share those voices with you later on in the hour. You heard some of the responses, right, Celeste?
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, it's great ideas. Somebody actually suggested you've got to get rid of those textile quotas, for heaven's sakes. I love our listeners and how they weigh in. And Celeste, you know, I talked with Carl Hyacin a moment ago there in the top of the newscast. You might say, and listen to this, this is what it would sound like if we were in the mind of Carl Hyacin right now.
I'll give you anything you want.
Little owls. Even if they are in danger.
Diamond ring.
We're the only ones who care.
I've got a little surprise for you.
Alexis. I love you.
Some random fragments of dialogue from the movies of Carl Hyacin's books, Hoot and Striptease. But if you strung together all the seemingly bizarre characters and punchlines of this novelist journalist, you might actually begin to get a clear picture of Florida. You a Carl Hyacin fan, Celeste?
Absolutely. I've read probably three or four of the books.
Politics is a dirty business. We've asked Carl Hyacin to come in and help translate Florida politics and culture. Good morning, Carl.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm actually having a lovely time down here. And I'm wondering, let's just set the premise right at the top. You have made a career out of describing the eccentricities and some of the political failures in the state of Florida. Do you think Florida is, in a sense, a snapshot of America generally in the future in terms of its inability to make a decision, divided electorate, and the entertaining show business that increasingly comes out of Washington?
Well, if Florida is a snapshot of the future America, then we should all be moving to the Bahamas. That would be my recommendation. I hope that it isn't.
But characterize the Florida politics for us. Why, I guess we all were surprised, and you alluded to this already, by the situation in 2000, Bush v. Gore, and the divisions and the way the election was conducted. But in many ways, what happened in 2000 represented trends that have been developing for a long time in Florida.
Well, it did. I mean, nothing goes smoothly here, and the partisanship that you see in Washington now has been a part of Florida politics for a long, long time, and we don't have really the gridlock, because it isn't that the House and the Senate in Florida are controlled by the Republicans and have been for a while. But in terms of the bitterness and the craziness that you see, I mean, I still think that Florida is ahead of the curve, even ahead of California in that area. Part of it is the extreme diversity that we have. As you know, if you go up into the panhandle of Florida, Pensacola and Tallahassee, those places, that whole section couldn't be more different from Miami. You really wouldn't ever dream that you were in the same state. Central Florida is completely different from North and South Florida. The Keys are different from anywhere on the planet. So you've got an incredible amount of diversity. And the fact that so many of our 18 million residents are from somewhere else, there is not an immediate native impulse to vote one way or another on anything. You've got these fractured constituencies and fractured cultures. You pick up the Herald today, and one of the headlines is they catch some guy importing giant African snails, and he's making his religious followers in Hialeah drink their bodily juices. You know, this is just, and it's not even like on the front page.
Why didn't we get that person in this segment as well? Well, talk about the Senate primary campaign. There's a Republican Senate primary campaign.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be a hotly contested race. You've been writing about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's Charlie Crist, our incumbent governor, and Marco Rubio, who's a young guy who served as the Speaker of the House in Florida for about 2 years, and he's running as sort of the Tea Party darling. And Charlie is a moderate Republican, which, is, of course, in this day and age spells certain doom. It's getting ugly and getting bitter, and this is just what every columnist loves, of course.
Carl, let's listen to a bit of a Rubio ad, and then you can deconstruct a little bit of the language and tactics, because as a Tea Party candidate, this is something of a bellwether. Listen to this ad from Marco Rubio.
Washington is broken, and too many politicians don't get it. America needs Republicans who will stand up to Barack Obama, not join him. Leaders who will stand for conservative values, not sacrifice them. If we are willing to do that, when it's popular and when it's not, we can keep America great.
Now, it's my understanding that Florida went for Barack Obama in 2008,
yeah, excuse me, I'm just wiping that tear from my eye because that was a touching, from a common man who used a Republican Party credit card to buy himself a $134 haircut. He's a real Tea Party hero, isn't he?
Wow. Is it possible to run against the president who won the state in 2008 and win in Florida?
Absolutely. We have high unemployment here. But keep in mind, this is the Republican primary, so this pitch is going to be completely different. He's attacking Charlie Crist because Charlie Crist stood on the stage with Barack Obama and accepted federal stimulus money. Now, in a state with an 11.5% unemployment, the stimulus money was, much of it was going to pay teacher salaries, police salaries, you know, real socialist things, right? Any governor who turned down that kind of money coming from the federal government would have been, hung in effigy, whether you're Democrat or Republican. Charlie's mistake was that he gave Obama a little man hug, you know, gave him a little man. Right. And by the way, if you see the film of that, Obama doesn't look terribly comfortable with the whole thing.
Right, right.
But Marco's been jumping on that. That's his big thing, the big hug.
Any chance, we've got the governor problems here in New York, scandals plaguing David Paterson, of course, Elliot Spitzer with the hookers and all that drove him from the governor's mansion. Any chance you're going to move up to New York? We could be outdoing you in New York.
Keep in mind that Elliot came down here for some of those call girls. We are still the epicenter of sleaze, and we're a magnet for all. There's always going to be a Florida connection, no matter where
epicenter
the scandal is.
Epicenter of sleaze.
Epicenter of sleaze. And Carl Hyacin right in the middle of it. Carl, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John. It's good talking to you again.
Great. Carl Hyacin, columnist for the Miami Herald, trying to translate Florida politics for us. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some stories we're following. Celeste?
Police and demonstrators have clashed in Greece during a large demonstration against government austerity measures. Hundreds of thousands of workers are holding a general strike today. That's the second in the past week. The government says it has to reduce its huge debts. Here at home, President Obama will meet with members of the Congressional Black and Hispanic caucuses later today to discuss his health care proposals. He says the plans would save taxpayers nearly $100 billion a year by making health care more efficient.
That abuse and improper payments is more than we spend on the Department of Education and the Small Business Administration combined.
Speaking of waste, a study has found that as many as 30% of patients who undergo tests for heart disease may not need them. Researchers at the University of California looked at the records for nearly 2 million patients over 4 years.
The world's most annoying British rock group Pink Floyd won a legal battle against its record label, EMI, in a dispute over how its music is sold online. A British judge ruled that EMI could no longer sell individual Pink Floyd tracks over the internet without the band's permission. The ban also applies to mobile phone ringtones. Pink Floyd, whose album Dark Side of the Moon is one of the biggest selling of all time, has also challenged how the label works out online royalties.
That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, Forbes magazine has released its new rich list for the first time in 16 years. A non-American is at the top. The details are coming in just a few minutes. Sorry, Bill Gates, you're number two.
Hey, you want that to go?
And it's time for some takeouts on stories that we're following this week. Forbes magazine has a new rich list out. I'm not on it, surprisingly, but for the first time in 16 years, a non-American sits at the top of the list. Microsoft's Bill Gates has been knocked off his perch by Carlos Slim, a self-made telecom mogul from Mexico who's worth $53.5 million. We should also mention he owns a stake that actually should be billion dollars, I'm sure. We should also mention that he owns a stake in the New York Times Company, which owns our partner, the New York Times. So how did he make his money? Joan Grillo has the answer. He's the Time magazine correspondent, and he joins us from Mexico City. Carlos Slim sounds like a Western movie hero, right? Joan, where did he come from?
Well, yeah, I mean, it surprises lots of people that a Mexican, you know, in a country which still has a lot of poverty, managed to amass this kind of fortune. But his story really started about 20 years ago when he bought the monopoly on the telephone service, which the government used to run. They privatized, and they sold it to him for what some said was a bit of a bargain price. And there's a bit of controversy around that deal some time ago. Now, from there, he built this real empire of both fixed phones and then cellular telephones. And some say he's had a bit of too much dominance in that industry, but he's had around the 70-80% mark on both those markets in Mexico, and then he's used it to expand right across Latin America with phone services.
Isn't it possibly just a coincidence that some of the men in the top of this rich list are often accused of monopoly practices? What has he been done since then? Obviously, he's diversified.
He has diversified. I mean, the core business is still phone services, but he's done very well in moving right across the Latin world. I mean, Mexico itself is a big money earner for telephones. You've got 105 million people here. About 70% of the population have cell phones now. You know, there's a lot of fixed lines and a lot of people doing business around the world. So that's a big market in itself. But also he's moved very aggressively and very well into markets across the world, right across Latin America. So in Central America, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Chile, in Venezuela, all these kind of countries. And also over in Spain as well, he's got a lot of money. So that's still the main core business that he's been making, his big money. He's got all kinds of other business as well, from chains, you know, a very successful restaurant chain, which you can find anywhere in Mexico. That's also owned by him. And as you say, moving into media outlets like the New York Times. And he'd also like to try and move into television and have TV services through his phone. But he's having a bit of trouble with the Mexican laws over that right now.
This is a rich guy in a relatively poor country. People might think that he's kind of a predator.
Some people do make that accusation. He's generally got a reasonably, hasn't been attacked too much in the press down here. And in a lot of ways, he has a lot of friends in the press. But, you know, people still, you know, generally on the street, people are going to complain that when the minimum wage in this country is about $5 a day. They say, how come is we have, you know, the richest man in the world? But also, he's not the only Mexican billionaire on this list. There's actually 9 Mexicans on the billionaire list in the Forbes this time. And there's some colourful characters there. There's the TV mogul, Azcárraga, who sells his soap operas around the whole world. But also, there's a drug trafficker called Joaquin Chapo Guzman, who Forbes have controversially, for the second year running, placed on the list, saying he's made about $1 billion selling cocaine, marijuana, and crystal meth to the United States.
Okay, Yoan Griot is the correspondent for Time magazine in Mexico City. Thanks, Yoan.
So our next takeout is listeners picking up the conversation. I'm in South Florida with our listeners at WLRN Miami, also taking part in a We Media conference yesterday. But because Miami has been a vital part of American aid to Haiti and has all kinds of connections to Haiti, we're asking all of our listeners this morning, what does earthquake-devastated Haiti need from the world right now? And, you know, lots and lots of suggestions, lots of answers to those questions, suggestions that include the practical.
My name is Fifi from Broward. I think the primary need is truly shelter. And I know we can't provide permanent shelter, but I think something temporary to help them deal with the rain and the mudslide that's going on right now.
Some of you wanted to remind us of the history there in Haiti.
My name is Gene from Savannah, Georgia. That country is a failed society and a failed nation. They achieved independence in 1804, and for the past 200 years, they've lurched from crisis to crisis. I think that we are just pouring good money after bad, and charity begins at home. And to quote an old Zimbabwean folk saying, do not mend your neighbor's fence until you tend to your own.
I wonder how many times a day Gene quotes Zimbabwean folk tales there. But some of you also wanted to get other things off your chest.
My name is Otod, and I'm tired of celebrities trying to jump in with the music. I am tired of that. Why don't they help before the damage was done? Where was the help before?
Lesson from Artud there, our listener. Celebrities, pick up a shovel.
One listener had a suggestion for the aid organizations that are currently working in Haiti.
I think Haiti can really benefit from the organization going to Haiti to bring help, UNICEF,
Red Cross, you name it. But I hope that they will also hire people in Haiti, Haitians who are qualified, who know the culture, they know the country, give them the opportunity to have a job.
Okay, so that's what aid organizations will do, but some of the listeners had suggestions for what Haitis can do for themselves.
My name is Paula Santeloy. I think what Haiti needs right now is jobs, and the best way to do it, we need to go back to our roots, which is agricultural, which we can feed our own people. Until we start feeding our own people, we're still going to have a lot of problems.
Keep those responses coming. It's an interesting conversation ongoing. What does Haiti need from the world right now? If you've been affected by the quake, especially if you're Haitian, what are you not getting that you still need? 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. Coming up from Florida to Illinois to New York, which one has the messiest politics? It's a little bit of a competition going. In the Empire State, they've got a good case. They've got a governor under investigation. A congressman just resigned. That's only part of it. We're going to look at the political mess in New York in just a few minutes. Good morning. A long conversation and I guess impassioned conversation going on our website over the conversation about race and who is a minority or a majority. One listener had to say, if Detroit, Zimbabwe, Haiti, South Africa, all of Africa, Birmingham, Atlanta are examples of what black leadership is, maybe we need to rethink race and who can participate in government. I bet we have lots of listeners who have a take on that. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or you can post a comment at thetakeaway.org. But coming up, we're going to be talking about different states and the political messes that are there in those states. Let's check in on the news stories that we're following, though, at 30 minutes after the hour. We're getting the preliminary results from Iraq's election. Our partner, the New York Times, says early on, Prime Minister Maliki's coalition, the main Shiite coalition, is likely to win the most votes, but it is extremely close, and a Sunni coalition is running a close second. Here at home, 48 governors have come up with a plan for nationwide standards, and our school calls on states to teach specific topics in each grade level, replacing the present guidelines that vary from state to state. The White House promises federal money to states who adopt the plan.
Last month, over 300,000 homes were foreclosed on, but it's the smallest year-to-year increase, only about a 6% increase in 4 years. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says Iranian support for the Taliban in Afghanistan isn't much of a problem for the U.S. right now. Gates says as far as the U.S. can tell, Iran's support for the insurgency is, quote, pretty limited. And we were talking just earlier this morning, the new world's richest man is a telecommunications tycoon from Mexico, Carlos Slim, the first non-American in 16 years, first man from a developing nation to be named as the world's richest person. Forbes makes the list, and the magazine puts Slim's fortune at $53 billion and change. Poor Bill Gates, he only has $53 billion, no change back from his $53 billion. Markets are now open, and after sort of fluctuating around this morning, markets are opening flat. This morning, the Dow is up about 2 points. The S&P, actually, I can't see the S&P number, but those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So we had an argument here in the studio. Maybe you'll remember this, John, where we had a visitor from Chicago who was claiming that Illinois and Chicago have some of the messiest politics in the country. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And you said, no, it's New York. And we just
heard, you can make a pretty good case for New York. I
was just saying the same thing to our next guest, Brian Lehr. He's the host of the Brian Lehr Show on our partner station WNYC in New York. And you know, Brian, I actually brought up at that point. I said, "Look, we have Kwame Kilpatrick in Detroit," and I was poo-pooed. Said, "Oh, you amateurs at messy politics, you can't match New York, Florida, Illinois, or some of the other places."
These are the ironic, messy times that we're living in. Everybody's saying, no, my state's the worst. My state's the worst instead of my state's the best.
All right. Well, the best at being messy. Let's go down the list here of what's going on in New York. And we got to start with the governor, David Paterson. And they're saying that he's on resignation watch.
Right. Well, that's the biggest one. And let me step back and give a little context here. You think of the stature that governors of New York have had over the years. FDR, Nelson Rockefeller, Thomas E. Dewey, Mario Cuomo. And it was supposed to be like that again when Eliot Spitzer was elected in 2006 after making a name for himself as the sheriff of Wall Street. Remember, he busted AIG's chops for some of its games years before the credit default swap scheme came to light. People said Spitzer could become the first Jewish president. But Spitzer got caught by his own hubris and his sexual appetite, and then his lieutenant governor, David Paterson, had to take over. Now, ironically, Patterson alienated the state legislature similarly by trying to paint them as irresponsible on the budget in a humiliating way, and his management style has been remote and erratic. Then came this bizarre series of scandals. He allegedly got free World Series tickets from the Yankees, then backdated a check to cover it up when the New York Post called him out on it. He may have given people he knows special favors to help them win a contract to install casino gambling at the Aqueduct racetrack. And the one that's most prominent in the news, he may have used the state police and some of his aides and even made a phone call himself to try to silence a woman who was accusing Patterson's closest aide of domestic violence. So all three of those things are under investigation.
So people are seeing if he has to step down. But we do have somebody from New York who has had to step down, and that's Eric Massa from the congressional delegation. He was forced to resign over a whole bunch of ethics allegations and obvious political differences with Democratic Party leadership. I saw a headline this morning for Massa says Rahm Emanuel hates me. So what is going on with Eric Massa?
They had some argument in a gym one morning. I don't know. But the details that are coming out about him include things like hiring lots of young gay male staffers, paying them very little, and then renting rooms to some of them in Massa's residence. All sort of allegedly. But that combined with a groping charge and wrestling and tickling. Do we have Ticklegate now? Is that what America has come to? And the next line of questions will involve, I think, whether Speaker Pelosi and others knew what was going on and swept it under the rug, like when Republicans knew about Congressman Mark Foley's bad behavior in 2006 and did nothing about it.
Well, if Eric Massa would stop talking, maybe it would become less of an issue, but he can't seem to get enough of the press. Now let's move on to Democrat Charlie Rangel, also from New York, from the proud Empire State. And last week, WNYC got some reaction, actually, from voters in his district after he had to step down as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee.
Everybody gets away with things. Why shouldn't he? You know, that's how I look at it. As long as he has African blood, he has to dot his I and cross his T's all the time.
Well, I think he just got caught up with the tiny little webs that he weaved. Particularly when he started off, he was a great guy, stellar guy. Bobby Till is a great guy, stellar guy.
Well, they don't seem too upset about it. Well, or maybe they just don't have very high expectations.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different feelings about Rangel in town. His problems are better known around the country because he's chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. People know about the corporate-sponsored trips to the Caribbean, which officially got him the rap from the Ethics Committee. Corporations that want things from the government like Verizon and AT&T. But locally in New York, he first became suspect when it was revealed that his landlord gave him four rent-stabilized apartments, which even if it's legal, really turns a lot of New Yorkers' stomachs because rent-stabilized apartments are scarce in this very expensive city. And one guy from the ruling class was given four of them.
Yeah, what does he need four apartments for anyway? All right, Brian Lehrer, give me your case. Is New York, do you think, the best at the worst politics?
New York is the best at the moment at having an unelected government. Get this. New York unelected governor, lieutenant governor, and state controller, all because of resignations from scandals.
Holy cow, appointed
U.S. senator as well, Gillibrand, because Hillary Clinton left to become Secretary of State. So our biggest hope in New York is that the November election will at least return the state to leaders elected by the people, not selected by their politician friends.
Well, at least if they're going to get in trouble, it would be the public's fault, right?
That's right.
Okay.
I love it. It's a bumper sticker, Brian. Let's start with an election.
Brian Lehrer.
Square one.
Is the host of the Brian Lehrer Show on our partner station WNYC in New York. What do you think? Is your city the best at the worst politics? Is your state the best at the worst? Give us your take on political dysfunction in local elections at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to be talking more about genius in just a moment, and we're going to talk to a math educator who has interesting thoughts about genius and failure. It's coming up.
We've been asking you to weigh in. How do labels of majority and minority fit in a changing demographic nation like the United States? What are your answers?
My name is Rusty. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, and I can't wait personally to be a minority. Maybe then I'll actually get some financial aid from the government.
Hi, this is Carolyn from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. This is my take on whites becoming the minority. I'm in the job market right now, and I'm finding this to be true. I don't speak Spanish, and I live in South Florida, so it's hard for me to get a job. I feel like I'm in the minority now.
Once again, we hit a chord, but you guys are always playing the chords out there. Tell us about your reaction at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Majority, minority, does it matter? Post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We'll talk more in a half hour. John Huckaberry here, coming from South Florida, live from the studios of WLRN in Miami. And back in November, we spoke to a WLRN radio host, Alicia Zuckerman. She hosts the radio series Under the Sun. And one of the interesting things about that program is that Under the Sun decides what stories they're going to do by asking their listeners to weigh in on what interests them, things in South Florida that they want answers to. Alicia and the people at Under the Sun take up the case. And Alicia told us back in November that one of the things people in Florida were really interested in was something called Naked Carpet Guy. Listen.
This is sort of an iconic institution sort of in South Florida, this carpet guy here. There are these billboards all over the place of this naked guy sprawled out on a carpet. His arm is strategically placed. And in a couple iterations, I've seen him wearing briefs, but that sort of goes back and forth.
That's Alicia Zuckerman talking on The Takeaway back in November. So the listener said, find out more about Naked Carpet Guy. And Sammy Mack, assistant producer for Under the Sun, was sent to look into the matter. Sammy's in the studios of WLRN with me now. Good morning, Sammy.
Good morning. And yes, we did look into the Naked Carpet Guy.
He has a name.
He has a name. It is Don Bailey, owner of Don Bailey Carpets, which is on the sign.
And you actually talked with him, and he gave you a little bit of his history. He's been in the business for like a half century. Listen to this.
I got a job as a janitor at Harry Rich Carpets at 8300 Biscayne Boulevard, and I worked my way up over 14 years. And I borrowed $5,000 and started my own business, which was almost bankrupt, until Burt Reynolds posed nude in Cosmopolitan magazine.
So Sammy Mack, Burt Reynolds gave him the idea to become Naked Carpet Man, not just Carpet Man.
In fact, he did. It was from the 1972 Cosmo spread when Burt Reynolds posed nude in the middle of the magazine, laid out on a bearskin rug, and Don Bailey saw this and had his brother make a sign with Don Bailey on his own carpets, and it turned his business around.
Now, a lot of places, say Des Moines, Modesto, California, you try something like this, it's going to kill your business. But Don confirmed what you're saying, that it actually turned his business around. Listen.
And whereas I was getting one customer every 2 days, 20 people, 20 women were walking in almost every day.
So carpet guy, naked carpet guy, get me some of that. What is it about him that gives him better business with less clothes?
Well, I think the sign has become so iconic, and it really touches that spirit of kitsch and sensuality that is so Florida. And, you know, he's been able to have a really successful business with this marketing campaign. And he also has become quite a philanthropist.
A philanthropist. Well, let's listen to that.
I try to take people from the inner city, people that are particularly poor, and I see the potential in them and give them jobs.
So earlier in the hour, Carl Hyacin suggested that Florida was the epicenter of sleaze. It sounds like you would put it differently with the Don Bailey story, that it's a sort of ocean of kitsch.
Yeah, absolutely, especially in this part of Florida, for sure.
And you can see pictures of the Naked Carpet Man at the takeaway.org, where there's a current photo of WLRN's Under the Sun, Sammy Mack. Where does it go from here?
Well, you can check out our website, WLRNUnderTheSun.org, to hear the full story of the Naked Carpet Guy and see an updated version, he's 76 now, of that photo that we've got online.
Sammy Mack, producer for Under the Sun. Your next assignment comes from the listeners. We'll have to check back in with you.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Sammy. Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry down here in South Florida, winding up our visit here this week. Celeste Headley up in New York. You know, you always feel stupid when somebody says smart or, you know, great job, genius, when you smash your thumb with a hammer trying to make something.
Right.
It turns out the path to becoming a genius, as our genius series continues, is filled with incidents called failure. We're going to explore that as part of our The Genius in All of Us series. David Schenck is going to join us in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama meets today with members of the Congressional Black and Hispanic caucuses to discuss his health care reform proposals.
It can't be if, it's got to be when. We are going to get this done, and we're going to get it done soon.
puts the president on the stump for health care reform. Democrats are now waiting a final cost estimate from the Congressional Budget Office. Our partner, the New York Times, says a single standard for all public schools in curriculum could, quote, transform American education. The Times is referring to a proposal that would create a uniform set of academic standards across the nation, a plan put forth by the nation's governors and state school superintendents.
Another story this morning from our partner, the New York Times. The Times says two research teams have decoded the genome of sick patients to find the exact genetic cause of their diseases. Researchers say it's now much cheaper to map the human genome. The approach may offer a new start in the effort to identify the genetic roots of diseases like heart disease, diabetes, and Alzheimer's. And Vice President Joe Biden wrapped up his trip to Israel with warm words of praise for his hosts. He says the U.S. has no better friend, but he says he does not support Israel's decision to build hundreds of new homes in East Jerusalem. Finally, back at home, a school district in northern Mississippi has pulled the plug on a high school prom. That's because a lesbian student wanted to attend the dance with her girlfriend. The school district says its policy requires that senior prom dates be of the opposite sex. It has canceled the event entirely. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Super genius. It is intelligence, which is the ability to learn from experience.
Exercising parts of our brain.
What sounds to you like a big load of trashy old noise is, in fact, the brilliant music of a genius, myself.
Believe in yourself. Exploring this notion of the genius in all of us this week with David Schenk, who's author of the new book, The Genius in All of Us. He joins us once again today. Good morning again, David.
Morning, John.
And also joining us is John Mighton, the founder of something called Jump Math, which teaches struggling students to excel in math. The question today, David Schenk, and let's just begin with this, is, you know, we've been inquiring, is genius a gift? Is it magic? Is it some sort of social mythology that actually enslaves more than it empowers people? But if you actually look at the pathways to what we call genius, a lot of those pathways are littered with something called failure. What's that all about?
Failure is the way to get better. This is the great secret that hopefully we'll let out to the world. All the great achievers know that in order to get better, you have to push yourself right to the edge of your abilities and then one step beyond. And you need to somehow get past that stinging feeling of failure or convert it into this ambition to learn from what you can't do.
And scientifically, what determines a person who can put the sting aside and really focus and observe what they need to observe from their own mistakes?
Well, this is the great news. It's an attitude thing. This is something we can teach in people. This is something parents and teachers can model for children. Say, look what I did in my life. I've had failures. Tell stories about failures you've had and about how you weren't just suddenly, you know, born with this certain ability, but you developed it along the way. And yes, there are tremendous setbacks.
Now, in the teaching of math, there are tremendous failures and tremendous bars to entry in the sense that people feel very, very intimidated by mathematics itself. John Mighton, you live this experience. You're the founder of Jump Math, teaching struggling students every day to excel in math. How does failure figure in to your path to success for young kids, whether they're talented or not in math?
Well, I agree with David that kids need to learn to fail. But there's a flip side to that. You know, research has shown that as early as grade 3, kids start to recognize who the smart kids in the class are, and we force kids to make a decision. If they're not in that group, they have to decide that they're either dumb or that the subject's dumb. So they become very passive or they become behavioral problems. And, you know, the evidence is the brain can change itself and people can learn things at any age, but not without attention and engagement. So if we force a half or two-thirds of the class to suddenly shut down, we're forcing the brain to work in the most inefficient way possible. So with younger children, you really have to give them enough support and make them feel good about themselves so they don't just give up.
And part of this, and it seems to me this is something that you have experienced, John, part of this is getting the students to not be afraid to go into a realm where they don't understand what's going on, right?
That's right. Yeah, and the results of that are just stunning. I mean, we saw one classroom in Toronto where the kids at the beginning of grade 5 were anywhere between a grade 3 and a grade 7 level. They were all over the map like most grade 5 classes. Within 2 years of using the JUMP program with a lot of support and helping kids learn to fail but still believe in themselves, By the end of the 2 years, all the kids signed up for the Pythagoras math competition, and 14 of the 17 got awards of distinction, and the other three kids came very close. So we're producing these crazy differences between kids at an early age that aren't necessary.
Wow.
Mm. Can any adult sort of respond to this? You know, we talk about kids a lot, but are old dogs capable of being taught new tricks?
For sure. I didn't go back into math until I was in my 30s. I was always afraid of the subject. Now I'm a research mathematician. The main thing is to go back to the level where you struggled and get the practice and the help you need. I mean, most people don't understand fractions, ratios, percents, decimals around the grade 8 level. If you go back to that level and really get good materials and work at it, you can you'd be shocked at how easy the math is when you go back as an adult.
You know, there's this story. Richard Feynman, the brilliant physicist out at the University of California, once said to his sister who wanted to learn about physics, his advice, just pick up a book and read until the point you get confused, then go back and read it again from the beginning. David, do you think that's good advice? I mean, who's going to argue with Feynman, right?
Feynman was a very average student for a while. He knows about elevating himself from mediocrity to greatness. I have to say, John Mighton is such a hero of mine. I write about him in my book. Here is someone who has taken the subject of math, which scares so many people. There are millions of people listening to this right now thinking, I don't have that natural ability in math. I'm just going to try to stay away from that. I just, you know. But really, they just didn't have the right opportunity or the right teacher or the right kind of inroad. And John is helping us understand that there are a number of different ways to appreciate math and to learn that we can be good at it.
You know, I got to ask you, though, David, isn't there a danger here? Because I know, you know, I got my master's degree in music, and there's a certain point at which you have to tell a student, give them the what we call the reality check. You know, you probably won't be able to make a living at this profession. You don't have the natural aptitude for singing. I mean, isn't there a point, a drawing line?
Well, in math, for instance, we've got all the data from some large-scale studies that you shouldn't be forcing that choice on kids too early. Later, people have to decide at some point. But we've got study after study, which you can find on the Jump Math website in the research section, that suggests you can close the gap between kids so quickly, and that you don't want to tell kids they're naturally good at things at an early age. That result that where all the kids wrote the Pythagoras competition and did well on it show that that's not a choice we need to be forcing on kids. Hmm. Maybe later people have to make that decision, but certainly not up to grade 8.
So John Mighton, David Shen calls you a hero. Are you a genius?
Well, you see, I mean, through relentless practice over years and years and of learning my subject, and this didn't come naturally. I almost failed calculus the first time through at university. I've made discoveries in math, so you would say I'm good at math, very good at math.
The first person in this entire week-long series who actually cops to being a genius, John Mighton, the founder of Jump Math, author of The Myth of Ability, Nurturing Mathematical Talent in Every Child, and of course, David Shenk, author of The Genius in All of Us. Thanks to both of you.
You can learn more about our Genius series, and you can actually read an excerpt from David Shenk's book and see some audio examples of genius throughout history. David is also answering your questions on genius all week long. You can post those to thetakeaway.org, and we'll publish his answers there. And John, you're down in Miami, and we've been asking listeners, many of them from Miami are answering, we've been asking them, because Miami's been a central point in America and aid to Haiti, we've been asking everybody, what does Haiti need right now?
Hi, this is Jack from Miami Beach calling. Rather than pass on billions of dollars to the remaining government of Haiti to disperse themselves, we should put to work all of the young Haitian men and women who would enjoy working for money, pay them through an administrative agency of the United Nations or the United States government, and let them begin the reconstruction of their own country on an hourly wage, which they all would like to have, so that the folks could be put to work and the reconstruction could begin.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or on our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
From Miami, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.